Dr. Francisco is assistant professor of historical theology. Prior to joining our faculty in 2007, he served at Concordia College in New York. Before that, he was Alban Salton Fellow at the University of London's prestigious Warburg Institute. He received his BA in Biblical Languages and MA in Reformation Theology from Concordia University, Irvine, and his MST and Doctor of Philosophy in Historical Theology and Christian-Muslim Relations from the University of Oxford. He is a member of the Association for the Study of Middle East and Africa, the 16th Century Society, the International Society for Christian Apologetics, and sits on the editorial committee of our faculty journal, Concordia Theological Quarterly. He is also the author of Martin Luther and Islam, a study in 16th century polemics and apologetics, co-editor of Theologia and Apologia, essays in Reformation theology and its defense, and a contributing scholar for Modern Reformation magazine. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Adam Francisco on the topic of the New Atheism.
Thank you. We have just under an hour. I have about 45 minutes worth of material for you, and then I'd be glad to answer any questions you have on the New Atheism and the topic. Another topic I'm going to broach, but I don't want to expose myself quite yet. 2004 was, for many reasons, an interesting year in the history of atheism. Rumors that Anthony Flew, the world's most notorious atheist, as he's called, was beginning to rethink his position were confirmed when he publicly announced he had become a theist. Explaining in his subsequent intellectual autobiography, consistent with the principle I have embraced since the beginning of my philosophical life, of following the argument no matter where it leads, the journey to my discovery of the divine has thus far been a pilgrimage of reason. I have followed the argument where it has led me, and it has led me to accept the existence of a self-existent, immutable, immaterial, omnipotent, and omniscient being. In the same year, Alistair McGrath published The Twilight of Atheism, wherein he traced the emergence, eventual scientific vindication, and then political legitimization of atheism from the late 18th until the 20th century. But he concluded that the seeming intellectual respectability of hard-boiled atheism had probably run its course. Its metaphysical assumptions had been exposed and intolerance criticized and challenged by the new, as he put it, cultural mood of postmodernism. In fact, McGrath argues that, while acknowledging many postmodern philosophers are indeed atheists, postmodernity does not for one moment imply or entail that there is no God. Postmodernity affirms a philosophical modesty, noting limits to our knowledge. It does not, and indeed cannot, make declarations concerning what exists and what does not exist. In fact, he continues, postmodernity seriously undermines the plausibility of atheism. McGrath seemed to confirm what many Christian postmodern thinkers had been and still are saying. Atheism and modernist epistemology have lost their influence and control over Western society. It is no longer the case, as Leslie Newbegin wrote back in the mid-1980s, that Western society is, in its public philosophy, atheist. The alleged tolerance indicative of postmodernity has opened all sorts of promising opportunities for the Christian church to express and assert itself without fear of reprisal from the atheistic forces of modernity. The way this works out, per the suggestions of some authors, is that Christians will no longer need to bother with giving a defense of the faith. For all intents and purposes, Christianity is absolved of the apologetic task, at least the way it was defined in modernity. But while everyone was jumping on board the trendy postmodern bandwagon, almost out of nowhere, shortly after Flew announced his conversion, and McGrath argued that strident atheism had been discredited, a book was published that seems to have changed the intellectual climate. Its title was The End of Faith, authored by a then PhD student in neuroscience named Sam Harris. The book immediately climbed to number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list and has been followed by a whole slew of volumes similar in spirit and unified in their agenda. A few examples include Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, published in 2006, Daniel Dennett's Breaking the Spell, also 2006, Victor Stanger's God, The Failed Hypothesis, 2007, and my personal favorite, Christopher Hitchens' God Is Not Great. All of these books and many more argue for the dominance of atheism as a worldview and the marginalization, if not eradication, of religion. And far from being abstract philosophical treatises written only for the intelligentsia, they were written for mass consumption. Their influence and the impact of their arguments have effectively ushered in just a few years what has been termed the New Atheist Movement. It is hard to define the New Atheism with any sort of precision. Victor Stanger, himself a neo-atheist, describes it as a, quote, militant, in-your-face kind of atheism, end quote, one which, with the exception of Madeline Murray O'Hare and her crazy ilk, had fallen out of fashion during the late 20th century. Others have characterized it as evangelical, for its chief personalities are overt in their intention to advance the atheist cause. Richard Dawkins, for example, wrote in the preface to The God Delusion, "If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down." More than a few of the new atheists could be described as ideological and totalitarian. Sam Harris, for instance, has suggested some religious beliefs are, quote, so dangerous that it may even be ethical to kill people for believing them. This sentiment, considered alongside his acceptance of the prospect of a, as he puts it, world government, is eerily reminiscent of the totalizing vision of international communism and its supporting philosophy of dialectical materialism. But other neo-atheists could be described as liberal secularists. Christopher Hitchens, for example, falls somewhere between neoconservatism, a term he rejects, and classic liberalism. Christian conservative talk show host Hugh Hewitt, in fact, intimated while introducing him at Biola University that despite their differences, Hitchens was still an ally in championing political liberty. Where the neo-atheists seem totally united, and one of the defining features of the movement is their espousal of what could be termed scientism, a view that asserts natural science is the only way to understand the cosmos. This is often informed by an ontological assumption, memorably expressed by Carl Sagan, that the cosmos is all there was, is, and ever will be. Recently in Berenstain Bears' Guide to Nature, I came across a similar quotation in a children's book. Nancy Murphy once wrote that if you find something like this in a children's book, you can guarantee it has a hold on the culture. Occam's razor, or the principle of parsimony, they argue, also demands that we view the universe as all that there is, because thanks to the telescope and microscope, as Hitchens puts it, the tools of natural science, it is no longer necessary to appeal beyond or before it to explain the universe and life within it. So how do the new atheists explain the origins or existence of the universe and the complexity of life on Earth? Looking at the latter first, because they are more certain and much more unified on this, they could all be described fairly as ultra-Darwinian fundamentalists, and that's Stephen Jay Gould's term. So firm and ideological in nature is their commitment that Daniel C. Dennett, a Tufts professor who wrote a decade before neo-atheism emerged, that anyone who even questions that the variety of life on this planet was produced by the process of evolution via the mechanism of natural selection is simply ignorant, inexcusably ignorant. And those incapable of passively accepting macro-level biological evolution across species as a fact should be quarantined. In his most recent book, The Greatest Show on Earth, Dawkins has argued that the theory, as he puts in quotes, of macroevolution is actually a fact, as incontrovertible a fact as any in science. And parents who resist it being taught as such in their children's schools are guilty of child abuse. As such, advancing Darwinian evolutionism is central on the agenda of the new atheism. Darwin's theory, by their own admission, only purports to explain the mechanism and general process of biological evolution. It does not explain where or how life originated. The new atheists are somewhat agnostic on this issue, with one exception. They will entertain theories such as directed panspermia, which supposes life came to Earth either, as Michael Ruse put it in Ben Stein's Expelled, on the backs of crystals, or, as Richard Dawkins suggested, through the agency of some sort of extraterrestrial intelligence. But what they will not entertain, even as a working hypothesis, is the agency of a supernatural deity. The same goes for their explanation of the existence of the universe. Victor Stanger, author of God, the Failed Hypothesis, How Science Shows That God Does Not Exist, wrote a paper recently addressing that perennial cosmological question, why is there something rather than nothing? This is and has been a major philosophical problem. It's especially a problem for the materialist atheist. Not to fret, though, science has a possible solution, according to Stanger, and here it is. Another universe existed prior to ours that tunneled through the unphysical region to become our universe. To be sure, Stanger does note the lack of any empirical evidence for such a theory. But he is quick to add that standards in contemporary physics and cosmology do not rule it out. Anything's possible in a contingent universe, except, as John Montgomery says, putting toothpaste back in a toothpaste tube. Therefore, Stanger assumes such a scenario must not only be plausible, but because it appeals only to natural causation, it or some other naturalistic model is the only conceivable one. This dogmatic naturalism or materialism is the worldview to which the new atheists are committed. To be fair, they occasionally do argue that this is not an all-encompassing ontological assumption. Rather, it is the conclusion they have drawn based upon a total consideration of the evidence. Knowing, however, that much of the same evidence in the same universe to which they appeal to validate their materialism is also used by others to vindicate theistic realism, much of the work of the New Atheists is directed at refuting classical theistic arguments. One of the standard and classical proofs for God's existence is the cosmological one. It can be stated a number of ways, but perhaps the most compelling contemporary formulation is William Lane Craig's Kalam cosmological argument, which goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The minor premise, the universe began to exist. Conclusion, therefore the universe has a cause. Craig then argues that from the very nature of the case, as the cause of space and time, this supernatural cause must be an uncaused, changeless, timeless, and immaterial being which created the universe. It must be timeless and therefore changeless because it created time. Because it also created space, it must transcend space as well as therefore be immaterial and not physical. Interestingly, the new atheists don't address this version, but instead prefer to attack historical versions, completely ignoring the philosophical milieu in which they were composed. For example, Richard Dawkins, going back to Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, renders the cosmological argument like this. There must have been a time when no physical things existed. But since physical things exist now, there must have been something non-physical to bring them into existence. And that's something we call God. Then Dawkins complains that this argument all depends on the impossibility of an infinite regress. Thus, he writes, to invoke God to terminate it is arbitrary. It is instead more in line with the principle of parsimony, or Occam's razor, to posit a natural cause, such as a Big Bang singularity, or some physical concept as yet unknown. Dawkins' argument is weak on several levels. First, it is anachronistic. Of course it presumes the impossibility of an infinite regress. This was part and parcel of the medieval philosophical milieu. Such a presumption, however, is not unfounded. It has in fact been demonstrated reasonable and veritable by contemporary science as well. Secondly, if Dawkins does not like God as an explanation for why there is something rather than nothing, he must supply a more reasonable one. This he does not do. Appealing to a Big Bang singularity still begs the question of causation. Likewise, suggesting we must wait for a physical or material explanation is a cop-out. It also betrays his assumptions. That a material explanation must be supplied presumes that this is the only explanation. A priori ruling out an immaterial and transcendental being seems just as presumptuous, and perhaps even more so than presuming the impossibility of an infinite regress. Another major argument for God's existence the new atheists spend a great deal of time refuting is the argument from design. The various ways it's formulated today is quite potent. In fact, Anthony Flew credits it with his newfound philosophical theism. Nevertheless, Richard Dawkins and others who follow his argument purport to deal it a death blow. The positive argument proposes that the best explanation for the apparent design of the universe and biological organisms within it is the existence of a designer. To the contrary, Dawkins argues, that while scientists still await an adequate explanation for cosmological design, biological evolution by the blind process of natural selection is a better explanation for biological design. Why? Because, he argues, a divine designer requires further explanation. Never mind that he acknowledges the materialist has yet to have an explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe, and that the probability of living organisms generating from nothing and then, regardless of how much time is allowed, evolved upwards from simple to complex has never been observed and is genetically impossible. If a divine designer is the best or most reasonable inference, it does not necessarily need further explanation. But positing the mathematically and scientifically impossible does. It is for this reason that what Dawkins calls a very serious argument against God's existence has recently been labeled by William Lane Craig the worst atheist argument in the history of Western thought. One of the most interesting arguments in the polemical repertoire of neo-atheism is their take on the moral argument. The argument can be stated numerous ways. In its most basic form, though, it asserts that the only way to account either for an objective sense of morality or the universal and transcendental nature of moral obligations is the existence of a divine moral lawgiver. Otherwise, the only other plausible option is moral relativism. Interestingly, the new atheists acknowledge this and ultimately posit the latter. And then they explain the objective feeling and transcendental appearance of morality as just another aspect of our evolution. Dawkins writes that the only reason most human beings strive to behave morally, particularly around other human beings, as if there is an objective and transcendental standard of morality, is not because there is a real immutable natural moral law. Instead, he claims, morality has simply evolved, either because of our genetic kinship, the anticipation of reciprocity for a moral favor, or the evolutionary benefit of having a reputation for being generous and kind. The new atheists have also used the issue of morality to advance a polemic against religion, particularly Christianity. Knowing, sensing, or perhaps just anticipating the accusation that once morality and ethics are torn from their metaphysical anchor, all standards of morality will disappear, the new atheists skirt the issue and point away from the epistemic and ontological problems of atheist morality to a host of moral atrocities committed in the name of religion. All the new atheists take a great delight in citing historical instances of theologically inspired violence. The Crusades, the Inquisition, the Salem witch trials, the mass suicide down in Jonestown in 1978 when I was about 5 and my colleagues were about 50. or at least one of them. The sarin gas attacks in Tokyo by Aum Shinrikyo, and of course the events of September 11, 2001. All of these travesties were carried out by people who believe in God. Thus, the new atheists argue, historical facts prove that religion or belief in God doesn't necessarily inspire moral behavior. One point I agree with them on. Sam Harris goes further, though, claiming that people of faith are actually the most dangerous people on earth. He writes, whenever a man imagines that he need only believe the truth of a proposition without evidence, he becomes capable of anything. It is therefore time we recognize that, he asserts, all reasonable men and women have a common enemy. It is an enemy so near to us and so deceptive that we keep its counsel even as it threatens to destroy the very possibility of human happiness. Our enemy is nothing other than faith itself. I know what you're thinking. Isn't it a fact that atheist political regimes and not Christian ones are responsible for most of the bloodshed of the 20th century? Isn't it the case that the sum total of all deaths caused by atheist regimes far outnumber those motivated by religion? And in fact, yes. Researchers estimate that under 300,000 people were killed during the Crusades, Inquisition, and Salem witch trials, the three chief episodes neo-atheists like to cite. But R.J. Rummel's Death by Government reports that atheistic communism led to the murder, or as he calls it, democide of 110 million people. Add German National Socialism to that, and the number increases several million more. Now, no one really wants to get into the blame game, but it certainly is interesting how the new atheists respond to this. Harris argues that while it is true that anti-religious regimes are responsible for the unprecedented violence of the 20th century, they were not rational anti-religious atheist regimes. They were, in fact, delusional regimes infatuated less with reason, quote, than with race, economics, national identity, the march of history, or the moral dangers of intellectualism, end quote. The neo-atheists and their agenda represents rational atheism, of course. Moreover, Harris claims that much of the violence and bloodshed in Europe during the 20th century was in fact rooted in its Christian history. The Holocaust is a case in point. According to Harris, the anti-Semitism that built the crematoria brick by brick and that still thrives today comes to us by way of Christian, and he's probably thinking Lutheran theology. But getting back to the allegation that religion inspires violence, and moreover, that the days of human civilization are numbered, as long as faith and religion remain influential upon the way people live and think, the new atheists evidence, on one hand, a bit of optimism, as well as, on the other hand, some almost apocalyptic pessimism. This is a characteristic they all share, in fact. For example, Hitchens ends God is Not Great by rallying his readers to the new atheist cause, the renewal of the Enlightenment, and the construction of a new rational civilization. However, he concludes, only the most naive utopian can believe that this new human civilization will develop like some dream of progress in a straight line. We have first to transcend our prehistory and escape the gnarled hands which reach out to drag us back to the catacombs and the reeking altars and the guilty pleasures of subjection and abjection. To clear the mind for this project, it has become necessary to know the enemy and to prepare to fight it. Daniel Dennett expresses things less pugnaciously, but just as assertively in Breaking the Spell, when he recommends that school, and not just science curriculum, be informed and guided by philosophical materialism. Belief in God and religion in general leads to ignorance. Atheism, however, leads to enlightenment. Counting on the victory of an atheistic worldview inculcated in schools, he writes, it will be fascinating to see what institutions and projects our children will devise to carry us, guided by atheistic humanism, all safely into the future. Harris likewise concludes in The End of Faith, similarly, noting that the success, but also the survival, of human civilization depends on whether or not religion and faith are marginalized and their legitimacy rejected. His and other new atheist fears are that if religion continues to be legitimized, it will be increasingly politicized and will play a part in informing secular politics, leading to what the recently deceased Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington called a clash of civilizations. He projected back in the 1990s that the shape of future conflict would be driven primarily by the underlying theology or worldview of that world civilization, of the world civilizations. The only solution and source of hope, then, in Harris's words, are seeing the days of our religious identities as numbered. Whether the days of civilization itself are numbered would seem to depend rather too much on how soon we realize this. It is this last sentiment that really drives the new atheists. Harris, Hitchens, Dawkins, and Dennett sometimes even designate themselves the four horsemen of the counter-apocalypse. The seemingly altruistic concern for humanity, as simplistic, naive, and even sappy as it seems, is what boosts their credibility too. It would be hard to measure in any meaningful way how much of an impact the new atheists have actually had. It's just too new of a movement. But what evidence we do have suggests it has experienced quite a bit of success. Not only have the key figures of the movement published bestsellers, indicating they are at least being widely read, but they are also influencing high school and college students. Atheist and agnostic student groups are popping up all over the country, alongside the ones that already exist. In addition to this rather practical local concern, however, the new atheists have been largely successful in reintroducing some of the same arguments and debates of modernity. It might then behoove us to ask what impact it has had, or at least should have, upon Christians, particularly those in environments where atheism thrives, particularly the academy. I think it is obvious that, at the very least, The rise and influence of the new atheism reminds us that the apologetic task cannot, or at least should not, be ignored. Nor should it be left solely as the province, Al Schmidt recently argued in his essay, Christianity Needs More Lutheran Apologetes, of evangelicals. After all, apologetics is, as Dr. David Scare once described it, and whether he remembers this or not is a different question, a necessary and biblical task. So does this mean we ought to start dabbling in natural theology and proofs for God's existence? An earlier confessional Lutheran theologian, Ernst Hengstenberg, answered in the affirmative, writing just as Darwin was thinking about finishing and publishing his Origin of Species. He wrote, "Materialism's appearance has made us aware of the significant deficiencies in the church in the area of scholarship. Modern existentialist theology is totally foreign and inimical to apologetic efforts. We are far less equipped than others with valid arguments for the truth of Revelation and its individual teachings. An overreaction to rationalism has made us lukewarm towards natural theology, which in older times was seen as the necessary underpinning of positive or confessional theology. These gaps must necessarily be filled." Is this still the case today, though? It seems so. I am not suggesting that theistic proofs ought to be the focus or even the starting point of our apologetic efforts. Context largely determines that. Moreover, we know, as C.S. Lewis implied in Mere Christianity, that acceptance of theistic proofs doesn't necessarily get anyone closer to the God of Christianity. Although we must confess that God can be known to exist by reflecting on nature or the basis of our intuitive moral compass, as marred as it is. It is only after one realizes, Lewis wrote, that there is a real moral law and a power behind the law, and that you have broken that law and put yourself wrong with that power, it's after all that that Christianity begins to talk. So where does this leave us? Not with the church's kerygma, but our apologetics. Might I suggest that our apologetics starts where Lutheran apologists have always started, with a positive case for and defense of the incarnation of God in real historical time and real historical space. For if there is a case not just for the existence of God, but a real, meaningful, and verifiable revelation from God, it is found, as Antony Flew himself recently intimated, in the historical and theological assertion that God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. Whatever our starting point, though, and we'll let the Calvinist debate over apologetic methodology, if we are to address atheism and any other contemporary challenge to the faith, it's high time we get involved in the most necessary and biblical task of Christian apologetics. And we've got about actually 20 minutes to left, and I would be more than happy to address any questions you have. You're much more gracious than atheists and Muslims.
Perhaps you could tell us how this type of atheistic philosophy catches on among college students, because when these books came out, I went to the local library in Pennsylvania to find out what was happening, only to find out that the kids who were working at the swimming pool were reading these books. Yeah. How is that done on a college campus? What's the reaction among young people? Yeah. And what would you say about one's child going to the university to study philosophy now?
Yeah. First question, how does this proliferate, I guess? It's hard to say. I only know from personal observation, but what I see is the new atheists, first of all, Dawkins and Hitchens are very, if I can use the term, sexy speakers. They have the British accent, which increases their respectability, it seems, and makes them seem smarter than they may actually be. But their cynicism resonates very well, I think, in a kind of postmodern, cynical context. Their books, somebody did a project looking at how many of their books are actually used in classrooms in public universities, and in fact, quite a few science profs are using Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion. So it seems to be coming in that way. A recent study, though, by Answers in Genesis, Ken Ham and Britt Beamer, in a book entitled Already Gone, suggests that it's not we don't lose kids at college. It only appears that way because they're finally out of their parents' sight. They're actually already gone while they're sitting in the church pew. And what Ken Ham suggests, and I don't know if this is all that relevant for us, but he suggests that when kids go through Sunday school, he calls it the Sunday school syndrome. He says there's a moralizing tendency in Bible study during Sunday school, such that as kids grow up and they're encountered with objections to the basic truthfulness of the biblical narrative, they have no idea how to address that. And over time, more doubt creeps in. Now, as the second, what was the second question? Do you remember even? I already answered it. Actually, the question was, should we be concerned about sending our kids to college? William Lane Craig actually says in philosophy departments, there's since, I guess, about 20 years ago now, been a revival or a he is Wesleyan, but a renewal in Christian philosophy, such that it used to be that all you had were atheists in philosophy, atheists and existentialists. Nowadays, there are Christian theists in respectable public university philosophy departments. Where it's really being promulgated, it seems, though, is in the sciences, the hard natural sciences. How do you combat that? I think C.S. Lewis would say, and so would Steve Mueller at Irvine, that Christians ought to be involved in natural science. Rather than running from it, get involved in it. But that's all. That's about all I got for you, sir.
It seems like the argument is the same that Paul addressed in 1 Corinthians about the wisdom of man versus the wisdom of God. And the power of God's wisdom will defeat man's wisdom, and that's why the new Proverbs commentary by Dr. Steinman I'm finding fascinating, because it's Christ being the wisdom of God has to transcend natural fallen man's thinking, and outside of that, Christ said the way is broad that leads to hell. Man can come up with an infinite number of speculations on his view of reality, but it's only the power of God in Christ and his wisdom that will combat that and open up sinful man to the redemption and therefore the ability to see and understand the universe as it truly is, as a creation of God. And I think 1 Corinthians, the first three or four chapters there, that Paul lays that out is a pretty good blueprint on how to fight that.
Yeah. What's your question, though?
Your comments on that.
Yeah. Yes. It does seem to me, though, that it is, and I don't treat this hypothetically personally, but if there is a real revelation from God, it is reasonable to see that revelation as trumping our own sort of opinions about what is the case. And that's why I suggest not just a preaching or a proclamation or asserting, but an apologetic based on squarely on the revelation of God in Christ, a historical revelation. 2 Corinthians 10:5, I believe it's 10:5, says that acknowledging that this is a battle of the powers and principalities, as it says in Ephesians, but also says we also demolish the arguments of our opponents or destroy the arguments of our opponents with the goal of bringing every thought or captive to Christ. So I think on a lower level, this is very much a ideological, philosophical, or theological, or worldview battle. At the same time, we of course begin and end our confession saying that God is the one who does any sort of work that is accomplished.
Pastor Mark Meyer, I've used Dr. Del Tackett's out of the Focus on the Family Truth Project, and I found him very winsome in defending Christianity and putting these questions out in front of the general public. Is there more to our apologetic beginning than being more winsome with our faith in the beginning of our discussion with society?
Well, more and more I'm convinced. I quite frankly, I love polemics, and I. but more and more I'm realizing that you can win all the arguments you want, but you're not going to make any, or you're not going to influence anybody unless you first start. I don't even like this language, but you start relationally. I mean, you'd be a friend. Imagine being nice and kind to people. I do take that as an assumption, but I do think that's the entry point. My experience with new atheists in town, or the atheist group in town, is if you come out with guns a-blazing, the wall immediately goes up, and even if you got the greatest scientifically valid arguments, they won't hear it. They'll filter everything through their worldview.
The old axiom, a man convinced against his will.
Yeah. I start a lot of my talks on apologetics by saying, you know, we take as our assumption that our starting point is loving people and actually talking and being kind to people. But that's the I assume that should be at the forefront of all of our apologetic endeavors. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm trying to formulate a question, so I hope you'll be patient with me while I try to do this. I'm interested in, let's say, a confessional Christian young person who, by all indications, has confessed and has a firm grasp of the faith. The movement of such a person into total apostasy and a denial of that faith in favor of atheism. I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that movement, the causality of that movement, and then if you have anything to say about the character of the ministry to that person to win them back, so to speak, to bring about repentance. Yeah. And let me just say parenthetically then, I am wondering if when such a person then has been a Christian, now professes atheism, argues for atheism using a lot of the arguments that I've heard you articulate from Dawkins and others, if that isn't really beside the point. In other words, that there's a moral and spiritual dimension to their fall, and finding a way to jettison Christ enabled them to be able to live with the moral condition that their flesh wanted.
Yeah, and that's Pieper, actually, volume one, I think around page 29 or 30. At the same time, I do think it is important to recognize that the new atheists or whoever, the objector to Christianity, we take them seriously. We don't just, you know, not that I'm suggesting you would or I or anybody here would do this. We don't automatically, when somebody comes to us and they've renounced the faith and they explain to us that maybe they're an atheist, we don't automatically jump the gun and say, you must be having an affair. Or I think we need to take their arguments seriously. Not that they're all that great arguments, and not that you're going to be able to respond to them in a knockdown, drag-out fight. But going to your initial question, what might lead to the move from kind of a confessional Christian to an atheist, or even there are several cases of people moving from confessional Lutheranism to Islam. What's behind all that? I'm not a psychologist, and to speak about how to minister to them, that's above my pay grade. But I will say, thinking about things I'm not exactly of college age anymore, but thinking about college, where at least some people claim to be interested in truth, encountering atheist arguments where they're arguing about the nature of the world, and if that Christian is hearing these arguments and has no idea how to respond to them, it might open up a little bit of doubt. Now, of course, it's all motivated, or it's all a result of the fall and sin, of course. But I read The New Atheist, and I think of a couple chapters in Hitchens and Dawkins' book where they take on the argument from a historical revelation of God and Christ, and they start their chapters by saying, we don't even know if Jesus existed, really. And then they go on and begin to discredit the historical reliability of the Gospels. And who do they use? It's no longer the wacky Jesus seminar. It's people like Bart Ehrman who are high profile, and the way most people perceive them is that they're he's the top New Testament scholar. Of course, our department's better, but and so I think there's a sort of intellectual superior or perceived intellectual superiority of some of their arguments. Now, I don't know if that answers your questions from a minister's point of view, but.
Subject. Can you give some examples of what you're talking about with the positive apologetic kind of assertions and arguments that start with the incarnation? I mean, are you talking about Pontius Pilate actually existed and the historicity of
the
Jesus
resurrection.
And the resurrection?
Mainly
and
the resurrection as the event that verifies the incarnation. Yeah. Think Craig Parton, Rod Rosenblatt, John Montgomery, that sort of approach. I would be in favor of that approach. In fact, the New Atheists here in town, the Atheist Club at IPFW down the road, a friend of mine presented this sort of argument to them. They had never heard it before. They had never heard a Christian argue for the historical reliability of the New Testament and the historical fact of the resurrection. So I don't know if there's promise there or not, but they were quite surprised to hear that Christians actually do this thing evidentially.
Yeah, you already kind of answered my question, but I wanted to make a comment and just kind of bounce back and forth a little bit here. Because I really appreciate what you were saying about the historical element. And you mentioned Ham's thing about, you know, the children. One of the things that I have done whenever we proceed to confess the creed is to say we now confess our historic Christian faith in the words of. Mm-hmm. And that word historic, I think, has a double meaning. Historic in the sense that it is what the church has always confessed. It's binding us to the church that went before us, but also historic in that it's grounded in history. Pontius Pilate, it matters that there was an actual person, the Virgin Mary, these sort of things. And I think that's, you know, one of the ways to try to help my people to, I think what Ham was saying is, oftentimes the accounts in the scripture are called stories or something like this, so that they're kind of seen as, you know,
legends.
It really doesn't matter with mm-hmm. if it happened, you know. And I'm always making mm-hmm. the point that, you know, it does. It's a lot different. You know, whether Confucius lived or not doesn't matter. His sayings are pithy and they're wonderful,
yeah.
You know. But
yeah.
And also then too, the argument I've made for the crucifix is that over against the emerging church too, that the cross represents Christianity. But when you have the crucifix, you have to deal with that guy that's on the cross. You were answering my question. It does sound like they're at least addressing somewhat, but it doesn't sound like they're looking at some.
Yeah, I really do think that leaving Christianity for atheism or something, it is an attempt to just, it's rebellion, I think, in many ways, youthful rebellion. Sinful rebellion, if you spend time in a public university where all you're reading is sort of this higher criticism masquerading as text criticism, it can be a bit unsettling if you don't know what to do with this sort of thing. Dorothy, speaking of the clause under Pontius Pilate, Dorothy Sayers used to talk about her dentist would tell her that he could confess the Apostles' Creed with one exception, that clause under Pontius Pilate, because that makes it real. He's fine with the myth, but he doesn't want the reality of it, the historical reality of it. I think that's kind of what Paul gets at 1 Corinthians 15. If the resurrection didn't happen, it's all, if it didn't really happen, it's a scam.